From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Joan Baez burst into the spotlight in 1959 at the Newport Folk Festival. She was 18, barefoot, beautiful, and her pure, heartfelt soprano carried away that summer's day. In the 1960s, Joan Baez was the popular face of folk.
It's another happy world to every happy fool, and you move through my dream like a trout moves through a pool. Sure, I will do everything, but I blush at the reverie. Sleeper, come and go with me. And he always was a painter, and he left me his suitcase.
She helped bring upstarts Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, and Phil Oakes to fame, and she walked the walk as social activist. She marched alongside Martin Luther King in Selma. She stood in the fields with Cesar Chavez and migrant workers, withheld income taxes, and went to Hanoi during the Vietnam War. She paid a price in jail time and in lost time with her growing son. Joan Baez has continued to sing, tour, and protest for decades. Now, at 62, for the first time in 6 years, Joan Baez has released a new studio record. She's looking again to new work and young songwriters, and once more, her famous voice brings tension and conviction to big ballads, little stories, deep politics. Many loves and losses on, in October, Joan Baez began another national tour in North Carolina. We caught up with her on the first night of that tour in Charlotte.
And a lover's tender hands, though he leaves my sovereign wood smoke for a job.
Joan Baez, 62, and hitting a tour that I'm looking at here. I mean, this is not a little one. This is a big one. Over the next month, you are really going to be scouring the country. Lots and lots of play dates. What does it feel like heading out on the road in 2003 at 62 after all the times you've had it out on the road?
Well, much more fun than it used to be. I'm less scattered and more able to enjoy life, so... In a way, it couldn't be better. I mean, people say, oh, you poor thing, you're in a different hotel every night. And I'm thinking, oh, goody, goody, another hotel where I can put do not disturb sign up and nobody's going to bother me.
And they will obey.
And they will obey. And I travel on a bus, and I love the bus, and I love my fellow musicians. And, you know, though it's always wrenching leaving home. It ends up at the end of the tour. I'm thinking, oh, why are we ending it so soon? We're just getting really good. So... best of all possible worlds at the moment.
I enjoy your new album, Dark Chords, on a big guitar very much. And I wondered as I listened to it how you sit with your own voice now, your own famous soprano and that vibrato and all the rest of it. How does it sit in your throat? How does it sound in your ear? I mean, a voice is a part of the body and a body ages. And where's it headed? How's it feel?
Gosh, you're the brightest person I've ever talked to. Nobody ever figures that out. And they say, oh, just go on singing forever. Well, it's really difficult to keep it up. I see a vocal coach, mm-hmm. and we tape my little lesson, and it's nothing you'd want to hear. Once a manager of a hotel came to my room, and he said that people are complaining they think there's a cat in the room.
That's Joan Baez.
That's right. That was me practicing. And I have to do that. You're right. The vocal cords are a muscle. It's like any other muscle in the body, so they need to be exercised if I'm going to continue using them. Then when the sound comes out, for the most part, I think, well, hallelujah, it's still there. It is much, much harder to sing, I have to say that. It's also, I was talking with somebody last night, and I realized that I feel a loyalty to my voice.
As well you should.
Yeah, and I'm not sure for how long, but it was a gift to me, mm-hmm. and I don't claim anything except maintenance and delivery.
What do you hear in it when you listen back to yourself now at different times in a singer's life, especially a singer like yourself, so attuned to what's going on in politics, in society? Is there an active effort, has there been in your life at different times to project some different sentiment or fundamental worldview through the timbre of your voice? Does that make any sense at all?
It does. I don't know about timbre because the whole business of singing for me was just an unconscious walk at the beginning. I remember in high school when I started singing and playing the guitar, this massive Gibson that hung down around my knees somewhere because nobody told me you could hike it up a little bit. And somebody said, do you think you're going to be famous? And I said, it what? I mean, it wasn't a plan, really. So the voice and the timbre and all of that. I like it now. I mean, I didn't realize then what a gift it was, and I think it's a big one. And you know, and most of the public has ever followed me knows that I've pretty much tuned into the political atmosphere wherever I am. And the songs, some of them written for that purpose, and others just sung and put in a context. For instance, when my ex-husband was in jail for draft resistance, he liked country western, so I'd sing Long Black Veil and dedicate it to my husband who is in jail for draft resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, so it doesn't have to be the words of the song. It's the context in which you put them. In the context of this new CD, it was not an attempt to be political, although the times had suddenly become very, really explosive.
They sure have.
And yeah, and I think, you know, it went through my mind, well, isn't this the time to do a serious protest album? And I thought, no, I would rather stick with this plan because it's sort of true to my heart. And interestingly enough, it comes out as a very dark record, which I think reflects the times and some of these songs from all of these people, many of whom were much younger than I. How is it they see this world? And it's in the songs.
Let's listen to a little bit more of that. There's so much we want to talk about tonight, but we want to get the sound of your voice out there as well. Joan Baez from her new album, Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. This is Motherland. Baez on a new album, Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. That's a song written by Natalie Merchant, former singer for 10,000 Maniacs. Joan, there's lyric right in there. You may say you didn't start out to make a protest album, but there it is. It sounds like almost lyrics that could be back in the 60s, the sprawl of concrete and singing about lust and the avarice, the bottomless, the cavernous greed.
That's true. There are many things on this that come out reflecting the songwriter's imagery of what's going on. Clearly, that's about the deterioration of nature. And, you know, also in these songs, and it fascinates me, there are things that I don't understand at all. Mm-hmm. And as it's always been for me, it doesn't really matter. I mean, they're just beautiful hunks of music. They're beautiful imagery. And sometimes I want to ask the people what they're about, and sometimes I really don't care. Motherland, the beginning of it at least, is very clear, the part we just heard.
It is, and then that call, Motherland, cradle me, close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Motherland. Joan Baez, we will have listeners who know every detail of your life, inside and out, frontwards and backwards.
Better than I do, yeah.
Well, it's famously public, and it's been out there for a long, long time. We'll have others that were born many years after you stood on that stage at Newport. Can you just take us back to your youth for a moment and tell us where Joan Baez came from?
Well, I was born in Staten Island, which is so dull that in the little pamphlets we put, I was born on a windswept island in the Atlantic. But I left there, family left there when I was very young, and I bounced around the country from the East Coast to West Coast a lot. My father was a professor of physics and a physics researcher. My mother was a mom. She was born in Scotland. My father was born in Mexico.
Quakers?
And they became Quakers when I was 8. When I was 10, oddly enough, and I remembered this only recently, I lived in Baghdad, and somebody gave me Anne Frank's diary.
I'm sorry, you lived in Baghdad?
I lived in Baghdad.
Why was that? For how long?
My father was with UNESCO for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a year in Baghdad. And Anne Frank's, maybe that book was the beginning of, you know, a lot of the social conscience that I was developing. That's pretty young.
So Joan Baez sitting in Baghdad reading Anne Frank, what a picture.
I know.
You've said that the Quaker upbringing and in a way that the stern requirements of it in some dimensions shaped you, faced you toward protest and social activism. Do you still feel that?
Well, I don't know about the stiffness, although the stiffness and the rigidity of Quaker, say, Quaker meeting where you sit and you be quiet for an hour, God forbid, kids hate it, and I hated it. But also in the meeting, people speak when they're moved to speak. And they are generally, a lot of Quakers are socially active and inclined to be doing good works around the world kind of thing. And so I was exposed to all of that. And I think it kind of gelled in me. I know the nonviolence came from there, and I had heard the endless hypothetical discussions about what would you do if somebody were going to kill your grandmother, et cetera. I'd heard them from age 8 on, and I'd kind of come to my own conclusions with the help of Quakers, my family, those discussions, and having seen the misery and the poverty that I saw in Iraq.
So when you stood on that stage at the Newport Folk Festival in 1959, you were 18, you came with this kind of religious, political wave
forever.
At your back, forever even. You had already been on the folk house, the coffee house circuit in the Boston area, is that right? Or did that come later?
That was right at that time. Mm-hmm. I sung in one little club. I sang in a few of them, then ended up in one called Club 47. It was in Harvard Square. Mm-hmm. And I sang there Tuesdays and Fridays, $10 a night. They raised it to 15, I think even 25 before I left and went out west.
Oh, right.
So I was singing, and then there was Newport, and then I came back and sang, and there were long lines of people around the block.
And who got you on that stage at Newport? And do you remember that day? Was it clear on that day that, hey, we've got something that's going to be big here?
I thought you were asking about the weather. Isn't that funny? Was it clear on that day because it was foggy and raining?
Was it obvious?
It was Bob Gibson. I had sung my only stint at a nightclub. I think I was challenged to it. And so I went to, it was before Newport, before all that stuff. And I went to the Gate of Horn in Chicago. And Bob Gibson was the lead. And I was his opener. And he liked me, and he was a very, very sweet guy. And he said, hey, you know, why don't you come to Newport? Because he was going to sing, and he would invite me up. So he did, and that's how I got on that stage at Newport.
Wow.
And I was scared stiff. I was so scared.
But they loved you.
Well, that's when I found out I could probably sing my way through anything, because I sang through that terror. And I also liked it. I mean, usually when I got started, I thought, this ain't bad, you know. And, there was a massive response, which probably isn't healthy for anybody, but there it was. And,
Joan Baez, stand by for a moment. We've got to take a short break. There's so much I want to talk with you about tonight. We're talking with singer-songwriter and folk music legend Joan Baez. We'll go into the break listening to an older incarnation of Joan singing Phil Oakes' There But For Fortune, 1964. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Show me the prison. Show me the jail. Show me the prisoner whose life has gone stale. And I'll show you a young man with so many reasons why.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with musician Joan Baez on the kickoff night of her tour for Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. Here's In My Time of Need from the new album.
Will you comfort me in my time of need? Can you take away the pain of a hurtful deed? 'Cause when we need it most, there's no rain at all, and the dust just settles right there on the feet. Will you say
Baez, A Time of Need, you're singing about there, and it's a beautiful song. We just had you at 18. Tonight we've got you at 62. Where do you find yourself? Is this a time of need or something else?
No, it's a time of growing inner, starting with inner relief and moving on to some kind of inner peace. Bluntly, I did the kind of therapy that I'd put off for half a century because it's scary, and I knew I had to go in there and rip things apart rather than try to glue them together.
That was over several years.
Yeah, it took a while. I won't go into details. I would just highly suggest it for anybody who's on the brink of trying to decide, because all of the things that disturbed me before that I thought I would be with forever, and the phobias and the panic attacks and the not being able to sleep and all that stuff, is gone. And so, yes, the impossible happened. Usually I think any of us thinks it'll never get better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a kind of a new life without all of that baggage. That's why I say I can enjoy the touring. I mean, really enjoy it now in a way that I couldn't before.
And we're glad that you can, but I wonder if you can pick that apart for us just a little bit, that panic attacks, the phobia, after you've gone through that therapy and come out the other side and look back, was that internal tension reflected in your music, in your social stand, in your political stands?
It has to have been, and I think that if we looked carefully at motives for everything, it would probably deteriorate down to the same level with everybody. I mean, what drove us to do this and what drove us to do that? I'm glad that whatever forces were at work that drove me to be passionate about the things I was passionate about, I'm glad they were what they were. Because if I'd been a homicidal maniac, I would have killed a lot of people. But I really, what I felt in my bones and my heart and my soul was what I did and what I sang. And there we have it. And all of that tension was in there. And you can hear in this album, there is not that kind of tension. And you sort of like it or not. I like it. I also like hearing my voice when I was younger. I mean, they're very, very different things.
Well, of course, millions of people did. But there's a new serenity. We can hear it. At the same time, when you look out at the world, I'm still wondering what that political Joan Baez is thinking. There's an awful lot going on that must get under your skin. I don't think there's enough therapy in the world to counteract what's going on right now to make a person, especially you, perfectly at ease about it.
Oh, I'm not at ease about any of that. I've never been as frightened of my surroundings as I am now. I mean, I talked about it for many, many years. This could happen. Watch out, this could happen. Well, it's happening. it's so dangerous now.
And what's the this? What's happening? Give us your take on what's going on.
Well, you can start with the fact that we have 3% of our old-growth forest left, which isn't just a sentimental issue. It has to do with the climate and with ozone layers and all of that. And I think maybe this year, maybe it'll click for some people, the most horrendous stuff that's going on with the global warming. And it was, this year was so crazy that maybe people will be willing to look at it a little bit. So that's a for instance.
So it starts with the environment.
Well, I don't know if it starts there, but I'm just saying it's part of it. Mm-hmm. And then the absolute insanity of what's happened in Iraq. Not that things like that haven't happened before, but I've never seen such obstinate, obdurate liars who bulldoze a public. I see that we're very easily bulldozed, which is too bad. This
begins to get at what I really want to learn from you, Joan Baez. Given that you were right at the cultural heart of social and political protest in the 60s, did you ever anticipate that 40 years on things would look something like they look now? What happened to all that energy? How do you interpret what's happened in the four decades since then?
I'm not sure. When you ask that question, the first thing I see in my mind is the pendulum, the famous pendulum. Mm-hmm. And I see, say, for instance, when I started singing long, beautiful, ancient ballads, it was in the face of a decade of what we call bubblegum music, mm-hmm. and the kind of a carefree attitude, a little very tinsely. And my reaction, I don't think it was necessarily conscious, but I was looking for something real and something. And then that developed very quickly. I was already political when I was 15 or 16 years old. And I did ballads for a few years and then moved directly into protest songs and worked with King and then against the war in Vietnam.
But you were hardly alone in that. In some dimensions, a whole generation thought of itself as having wrapped around that impulse.
After a while. And the first protest march I went on was in about 1962, and there were 30 of us, mm-hmm. you know. So it's always going to start small. And I think it was maybe a little deceptive. It was wonderful, having 7 million people march in one day. I was there this time around, sort of thinking, what in the hell am I doing here again? I didn't plan on it, and I don't like it. I don't like this happening.
But here we are 40 years later, and that generation, your generation, I guess you could say, is at the kind of the height of its powers in American society today. I mean, whatever power and stature it's going to accumulate, it's got it. And you say you've never been more frightened about where things stand.
Yeah, because I think power translates now into either weaponry or just plain money. And that's happened with, I think that's happened with the kind of laziness that comes with not having to feel the friction of bad things happening in the world. And as my generation became more and more privileged, mm-hmm. They felt more and more inclined to bother. As you see Michael Moore's videos of having a guy lying in the middle of the sidewalk and seeing if anybody will stop and do anything about it. It takes a lot of people walking past this person for anybody to, well, they notice him out of the corner of their eye, and then they keep a good distance. So that's kind of what we created. It is about greed, and that's a sad thing to say. It isn't just trite, but I think we got greedy.
Even the 60s generation?
Oh, sure. I mean, you can get older, and a lot of 60s generation. I think one thing that may make it easier for me to at least remain with my beliefs and feelings and doings is the fact that I came to it before civil rights and before the war in Vietnam. If the war in Vietnam is what politicized somebody, then when it was over, there was a good chance that their political inclinations were over with it.
I mean, I think that's
Nandrani, who took us backwards.
Yeah. Joan Baez, it's great to hear how you look back on all that. We want to also keep an eye on this new music because it's wonderful. Let's play another song from the CD, Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. This is Joan Baez singing a Josh Ritter song, Wings.
That night we crossed the border, following a black robe to the edge of the reservation. Took a Talga mission where the saints and all the martyrs look down on dying converts. What makes the water holy is that it's the closest thing to rain. I stole a mule for
from Anthony, helping up upon it. And we rode to Curtin Lane, past Harrison and Wallace. They were blasting out the tunnels, making way for the light of learning. When Jesus comes a-calling, he's coming around the mountain on a train. My home. Last night I dreamt that I grew wings. I found a place where they can hear me when I sing. Floated on to Hanford on a lumber boat upriver. Past the fishers and mill towns, like a stretch of future graveyard, she was driven to distraction. Said, I wonder what will happen. They find out they're mistaken, and the land is too changed to ever change.
Joan Baez singing Wings from her new album Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. She launches a national tour tonight in Charlotte, North Carolina. Joan Baez, you have repeatedly throughout your career reached out to young performers, young songwriters and musicians, and used their material. You're doing it a big time again on this album. Songs by Steve Earle and Gillian Welch, Dave Rawlings, Ryan Adams, Natalie Merchant, Greg Brown. Does it keep you young?
Good question. Yeah. I mean, it does, and so does having a band of, you know, they're all somewhat younger than me, and some of them considerably younger than myself. And I realized something about, as music changes, there are just elements that weren't there for me before, or I didn't notice them. But say my drummer, George Javori, plays those drums. It's like a little tiny symphony in back of me. And I feel as though I could sing anything with him. And that's new. And anything that's new makes me feel fresh. And when I feel fresh, I can deliver in a fresh way.
And in the work that you're choosing now from everything that's out there, I mean, you could basically have your pick. Can you hear a trademark sound of this generation that you're singing now in this album? Is there a different tone, a sound you could define?
I have trouble defining it because I'm not sure what it is, and I'm not sure how much of that came as the record came together and as there were three musicians, myself, producer, and engineer, and that was all. And it came together very quickly. And what we ended up with was something that was somehow consistent. And I don't know if that was how conscious that was or wasn't. I know that the songs I picked 30 years ago and 40 years ago were generally not conscious decisions for any reason. They just rang a bell. So it must be the same process now to one degree or another. And I love the fact, say Wings, that we just listened to. I do not understand that song. I don't understand the first thing about it. And it doesn't matter to me. It's just beautiful.
When you look out at the sort of cohort that you came up with in the 60s, everybody's taken a different path in one way or another. Do you keep an eye on what they're singing and imagine yourself in their skin? You know, how did Bob Dylan end up where he ended up? Leonard Cohen, do you track their careers as well?
I don't track them, but when something comes up, like I was on a French TV thing one day and they were playing before I went on. It was like a documentary of Leonard sitting in his Zen robes and absolutely unbelievable, that guy. I love him and I love his work. And he was saying in French, and I understand it well enough. They said, why do you write these songs? Why do you write them? He says, because I have to find some way to describe this shit. I don't know what you do and how you bleep that out. But he's perfect. I mean, he's appropriately caustic for me. So I don't know what got him there and what got Dylan to continue on the road and just staying on the road and continue creating. It's like it's as though he can't stop. And what makes me end up spending a lot of time quiet and in meditation, conscious meditation, is probably how I'm going to make it through this decade if the decade continues. And there was one thing I wanted to say about now, which is that I have friends, actually specifically Derek Jensen, who wrote a book called The Culture of Make-Believe, which is very much like Michael Moore's calling this a fictional society with a fictional president and, you know, doing a lot of pretending. And Derek Jensen's book really is rough, and he's pretty much saying we've already had it. I mean,
what do you mean when you say had it?
We've blown so much. You know, earlier I just mentioned the redwoods, you know, the environment, ecology, the poverty that's going around the world, incomprehensible, the way the human race has behaved and behaving. And when he said that, it's, you know, it's over. Instead of feeling depressed and panicked, I felt a kind of a relief at looking at the whole thing in a different context. What it meant to me was, how do I be a decent person? Where do I find my slot in a world that really isn't glued together the way I thought it was, or the way I was trying to keep it glued together?
It won't be glued together that way.
Uh-uh. We have to find some other thing, some way to survive it, to make it. I don't know yet. I don't know. And I know that I feel, as I felt 40 years ago, that aching for the people who are suffering, and now so many suffering at our expense. And I'm a part of the hour, you know. I know that.
And the fictional society Derek writes about, how do you interpret what that means?
Well, that we believe that the history books are written the way they're written. I think one has to read Staunton Lynn's book about, you know, the real history of the United States and what we did to the American Indians. And, I mean, it's fun watching John Wayne. And it's not real. And we're really more than before, maybe more than when I was young, willing to accept the shiny side of CNN, you know, the smiling people who deliver us this deadly news every day. I don't know. Maybe they're just trying to keep from going crazy. I don't know.
Have I
depressed you sufficiently?
Yeah, but you sing us back out of it, and that's always been your saving grace. We're talking tonight with Joan Baez, the woman who helped put folk music on the map in the early 1960s and is still going strong. Let's go into this break with a rocker, King's Highway by Joe Henry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Joining us tonight from Charlotte, North Carolina is Joan Baez. Here's Caleb Meyer by Gillian Welch and David Rawlings from Joan Baez's new album, Dark Chords on a Big Guitar.
Caleb Meyer, the ghost is gone, aware of the rattling chains. When I go to sleep at night, don't you call my name. Where's your husband, Millie Kane? Where's your darling gone? Did he go on down the mountainside, leave you all alone? My husband's gone to Bowling Green to do some business there. Then Caleb threw that bottle down, grabbed me by my hair.
Joan Baez, you're 62 and you're rocking there. How does that feel?
Time,
is it an extra espresso or what gets you in that groove?
Actually, when the musicians start playing, it's just whoop-de-doo. That has kind of always been there, even in my more sort of political, slightly more grim early days. I always liked to dance.
When they picked it up, it picked you up.
Yeah, that's true, and it's true now. Also, I didn't like ending that last segment where we did all doom and gloom. For some reason, I'm able to experience a tremendous amount of joy. because that's there as well. I mean, Gandhi talked about human nature. He said part of it is loving, wants to be loved, is caring, you know, like most moms most of the time. And then part of us is destructive, reactionary, not very bright, and violent. And he said the question is, which part are we going to organize? And obviously he chose the difficult way, which is to organize with nonviolence. And King chose the difficult way. And Christ chose the difficult way.
With all that, I'm fascinated by your notion of all that you tried to hold on to and accepting that it's not going to hold together in that way, that the glue's gone in some dimension and flowing with that. I mean, that's accepting a lot.
Well, what do you think?
I think anybody who speaks honestly from the heart and looks around honestly may come to a very similar conclusion, and yet there's something in human beings that doesn't want to see all the glue gone, that doesn't want to let go of that paradise in our minds.
Because it means you're going to have to build something else and behave differently and give things up. And I mean, Gandhi's life was an experiment. He called it experiments in truth with a small t. And most of us don't do that.
You've written, Joan Baez, all of us are survivors, but how many of us transcend survival? What do you mean by that?
Well, some people don't have a choice, because if you're living hand to mouth, and many, many people in the world are, some of those people have some kind of light within that came from God knows where, and they transcend in spite of everything. Mm. Many of them cannot. Those of us who are more privileged, how do we get past the feeling that we're kind of getting through the day and getting to the next day and transcend that into some kind of real glory? And part of that for me comes from music that I listen to. I listen to my favorite tenor, is a tenor named Björling. He's Swedish. He's around in the 30s, 40s. And I just... oh, my God, one song. Is that why I'm here? I mean, was that why I would go on fighting for something decent?
Yeah.
And it's enough. It's enough.
Tell us a bit more about your life these days, Joan. We know for the next month you're going to be on the road, but when you're not on the road, are you back in California? Is that your base
I'm
now?
I'm back in California, and I am learning about family. Before I, quote, got a little better, I didn't understand many of the dynamics. I didn't understand about my mom getting old. My mom's 90. She's going to come out on tour.
With you, though, in California.
I mean, that was one of the smartest, aside from having my son, it was the smartest move I ever made in my life.
Having your mother?
Having my mother, you know, giving birth to my mother.
Right.
Well, in a sense, it's giving birth to her right to be the matriarch on our property. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are five or six people living on the property, and she's learning that she is the elder, and I'm learning from her what it's going to be like. And that's so important, and we're so busy avoiding it in this country. So I spend a lot of time with my mom, and I spend a lot of time in my tree. I have a platform about 20 feet up in an oak tree, and it's a place where I can go 20 feet off the ground and be with nature. And I've discovered the birds that'll eat out of my hand and the ones that won't. And some of the ones that won't are getting unscared enough to come and eat out of my hand.
That's great.
And that, I love that.
Tell us, Joan Baez, who is Madame Zinzani?
Ah, yes, another character. About 3.5 years ago, somebody said, you got to come and see this circus dinner club with me. It's really funny. So I went, and it was that 300 people eating dinner and this madhouse going on around
them. A circus dinner club.
They serve a 5-course meal, and the whole time there are jugglers and fire eaters and people on trapeze, magicians floating around, and then in between meals there are regular acts.
Yeah.
I fell in love with this thing when I went to see it. I called the director. I met them all, you know, because I'm lucky.
Sure.
And I called the next day. I said, I want to dance with a magician. He said, oh, sure, that would be easy to work out. By the way, I think you ought to play Madame Zinzani. She's the hostess for the evening.
So Joan Baez comes out as Madame Zinzani. What, are you dressed in sequins and ostrich plumes?
I am dressed in, exactly. Did you see a picture or are you just imagining it?
The name brings it straight to mind.
Blonde wig with a part on the opposite side. That was my clever idea. One of the funnest things that happens there is somebody will come up to the stage manager after and say, where's Joan Baez? Didn't she ever show up?
She's not in the house. It's Madame Zanzani.
Exactly. Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. S'il vous plaît, sit down. Now be quiet because we're going to start the show.
Joan Baez, we're so happy to hear that you're having that kind of fun out there.
Me too.
We're out of time tonight, but it's been a great pleasure having you. We thank you for the new album and wish you great luck and fun on your new tour.
Tom, thank you very, very much.
We'll end the show with Christmas in Washington from Dark Chords on a Big Guitar, Joan Baez's first studio album in 6 years. Find more on Joan Baez's new CD and her tour dates online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's Christmas time in Washington. The Democrats rehearsed, getting into gear for 4 more years. Things not getting worse. The Republicans drank whiskey neat and thanked their lucky stars. Said he cannot seek another term. There'll be no more FDRs. I said,
the end of the calendar year is almost here, a time when Americans are thinking about 2004 and what the future will bring. On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors says this shouldn't be surprising because America has always preferred to tell its story in terms of the future, not the past. This week we're bringing you some of Ned Connors' best pieces of 2003. Tonight, Ned digs up an audio history of America's obsession with the future.
In 1963, Bill Bixby welcomed a Martian into his living room. He moved in. No big cultural adjustments. Perhaps Uncle Martin wasn't good company among 20th century Americans. Tocqueville observed it in the 1830s, just a few generations removed from the Revolution. Americans were a hurried, edgy people, little concerned with their past. Late in the 19th century, flush with the mix of terror and excitement of the new industrial world, we began to create a mythology not of the past, but of the future. Earthbound fantasies of Puritan cities on the hill gave way to new, decidedly secular, extraterrestrial worlds. As those fantasies took on cinematic or televised form in the 20th century, we needed soundtracks. In the 1920s, Soviet scientist Leon Theremin gave birth to a radio-inspired instrument you didn't even have to touch. The artist stood in an electromagnetic field and with precise hand movements produced otherworldly musical sounds. In 1947, Dr. Samuel Hoffman, a former chiropodist and America's leading cinematic thereminist, was paired up with composer Harry Revel on a West Coast session released as Music Out of the Moon. This was the first of a new genre, space music. Here's Hoffman with the Leslie Baxter Orchestra on a cut from that album, Celestial Nocturne. The music of the future would have a harp, vocal chorus, and the ethereal sound of the theremin. But futuristic music didn't have to be about space. Sometimes it gave a nod to our past. In 1955, RCA released an experimental box set of 45s introducing the electronic music synthesizer. Here's an RCA engineer's completely programmed version of an Earthbound Stephen Foster melody. The same year that RCA introduced their synthesizer, the voices of Walter Schumann, who also had a hit in 1955 with Disney's Ballad of Davy Crockett, recorded the choral space music to Leith Stevens' narrated journey to Venus, Exploring the Unknown. I think when Gene Roddenberry was dreaming up Star Trek, someone gave him a copy of this album.
140 days out from Earth. And now close ahead is Venus, planet of mystery, guarding her secrets beneath a dazzling white cloak of bright clouds. This is the new frontier. What lies behind those clouds? Is there life? And if there be life, what manner of living things will we encounter?
A dozen years later, we began a journey where no television audience had gone before. Star Trek, ostensibly about space, spoke more to American hopes and anxieties in the 60s. Racial and gender equality, the Cold War. From the deck of the Enterprise, it seemed a reasonable idea that the entire universe could be persuaded to adopt American principles of democracy, justice, and expensive gadgetry. Star Trek's theme music drew its inspiration from the stark, dreamy space music of the 50s. Composer Alexander Courage gave us a hybrid future music, the whooshing of the Enterprise backed by a theremin-sounding female chorus. Seizing on the popularity of the series, Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock, released music from outer space during the show's second season. Much of the album is Nimoy narrating and the character of Spock, but a few instrumentals are tucked in. Here's the Star Trek theme as we might have heard it in a space discotheque. Voyaging from the sublime to the ridiculous. In 1960, Hanna-Barbera scored an unexpected hit in network television's first animated series, The Flintstones, kind of a Cro-Magnon honeymooners. 2 years later, they tried the same idea, but this time in the future. If a Stone Age suburban sitcom worked, why not move the suburbs way out? The show's theme was written by Hoyt Curtin, Hanna-Barbera's musical director. Gone was the solemnity and mystery of space. The future was slapstick. A nuclear family, galactic capitalism, and the ultimate in detached housing. And the future had bongos. It would be brassy and a little neurotic.
Jane, his wife.
In the late 70s came Star Wars, the next epic in America's extraterrestrial mythology. What were they playing on the bandstand of an intergalactic cantina? What did we listen to? Not in the future, but in some remote futuristic past. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, barroom music sounded a little like Benny Goodman turned inside out and played on steel drum. Uncle Martin would have felt right at home.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Merry Christmas, everybody. This is On Point.